content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media. The Triangle Radio Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we are reading this week from the December 9th, 2016 issue of the Week magazine, the main stories and how they were covered. Trump fills out a conservative cabinet. What happened? Donald Trump named a series of nominees for major cabinet posts this week, stocking his administration with a mix of hardline conservatives, Wall Street veterans, and GOP establishment figures. To head the Department of Health and Human Services, the president-elect chose Representative Tom Price, a Georgia doctor who has authored a 242-page plan to replace the Affordable Care Act and who advocates overhauling Medicare and other entitlement programs. Trump tapped Hollywood financier and former Goldman Sachs executive Steven Mnuchin for Treasury Secretary and selected billionaire Betsy DeVos, a major Republican donor, to lead the Department of Education. Mnuchin, who served as finance chair of Trump's presidential campaign, says his chief priority is lowering corporate and personal tax rates. DeVos is a longtime foe of teachers' unions and a staunch proponent of school choice and voucher programs. Praised by many conservatives, the nominations drew fire from leading Democrats. "This isn't draining the swamp," said Ohio Senator Sherrod Brown. "It's stocking it with alligators." For his Commerce Secretary, Trump nominated billionaire investor Wilbur Ross, a 79-year-old turnaround specialist known for buying troubled companies and restructuring them, often with substantial layoffs. The president-elect also drew on Washington insiders. His choice for Transportation Secretary, Elaine Chao, served as Secretary of Labor under President George W. Bush and is married to Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell. Trump nominated Governor Nikki Haley of South Carolina as ambassador to the United Nations. A Ted Cruz backer in the GOP presidential primary, Haley once called Trump everything a governor doesn't want in a president. Speculation swirled around Trump's possible Secretary of State. Among the names under consideration were retired general and former CIA director David Petraeus, former New York City Mayor Rudy Giuliani, and former U.N. Ambassador John Bolton. But the most intense debate was over former Massachusetts governor and 2012 Republican presidential candidate Mitt Romney, a possibility that divided the president-elect's own team. Senior advisor Kellyanne Conway said the president-elect's supporters would feel betrayed if he chose Romney, who attacked Trump as a phony and a fraud during the campaign. After the two men dined together in Manhattan this week, Romney said he had increasing hope that Trump would lead the nation to a better future. What the editorial said: Trump is confounding naysayers who assumed he'd bear grudges all the way to the crack of doom, said the Washington Examiner. Instead of exacting revenge, the president-elect is choosing from among the ranks of his fiercest critics and most stalwart opponents. It's heartening to see Trump displaying such equanimity and broad-mindedness. Trump just tapped two smart, tough women to help lead his administration, said the New York Post. In selecting Haley, the president-elect is helping a rising Republican star, letting her gain crucial experience en route, presumably to yet higher office. DeVos, meanwhile, has been fighting for education reform for decades. Charter schools will have a potent friend in Washington. Price is a radical choice for health secretary, said the New York Times. His plan to replace the Affordable Care Act would, among other things, roll back the federally financed expansion of Medicaid in 31 states, taking coverage away from 14 million poor people. It would slash subsidies that have helped millions of people afford coverage since Obamacare went into effect. And it would no longer require insurers to cover addiction treatment, birth control, maternity care, prescription drugs, and other essential medical services. What the columnist said, "Get ready for an epic showdown over the fate of Medicare," said Greg Sargent in the Washington Post. Trump promised to protect the entitlement on the campaign trail, but Price wants to gut the popular program and offer seniors a voucher toward private insurance. Critics say that would inevitably result in higher costs for elderly recipients because their fixed benefit from the government would fall behind rising health care costs. Price's confirmation hearing is sure to be explosive as progressives like Senators Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren hammer home the true radicalism of Trump's agenda. Trump's Secretary of State drama has overshadowed a more important story, said Jonathan Tobin in CommentaryMagazine.com. All the contenders for the post, Romney, Giuliani, Bolton, Petraeus, support the sort of internationalist foreign policy that Trump opposed as a candidate. No matter who gets the nod, it seems his administration will have far more in common with his Republican predecessors on foreign policy than anyone might have imagined. That he's even considering Petraeus is shocking, said Brian Bender in Politico.com. Trump insisted Hillary Clinton's use of a private server for the State Department emails made her unfit for high office. Yet Petraeus pleaded guilty to leaking reams of classified information to his biographer mistress and was sentenced to 2 years of probation and fined $100,000. Let's not jinx it, but this incoming cabinet looks pretty darn good so far, said Jim Garrity in NationalReview.com. Considering the limited circle of connection and talent that surrounded Trump during the campaign, this group is solidly conservative, sufficiently experienced, professional, knowledgeable, and prepared. They could be stunningly effective, quietly repealing regulations and executive orders and pushing through legislation while the political world froths at the mouth about the president's latest tweet. The controversy of the week, Trump flip-flopping on campaign promises. Is Donald Trump a hypocrite? Asked Michael Gerson in the Washington Post. For the nation's sake, let's hope so. Only days after winning the election, Trump elicited howls of protest from his more rabid supporters when he walked back his chilling campaign pledge to prosecute Hillary Clinton. He then went on to praise President Obama, formerly the worst president in history, and say that he was open to preserving some elements of the Affordable Care Act. Last week, in an interview with the New York Times, Trump retreated even further toward realism and good sense. On climate change, the president-elect now claims to have an open mind about the Paris Agreement to slash emissions, which he once threatened to tear up, and is apparently no longer convinced of the need to bring back torture for terrorist suspects. It's been a breathtaking fortnight of flip-flopping from Trump, said David Ignatius, also in the Post. Ordinarily, we look for consistency and principle in our politicians, but given the reckless and damaging pledges he made on the campaign trail, perhaps we should be thankful this week for Donald Trump's insincerity. Don't be fooled, said Robinson Meyer in TheAtlantic.com. The president-elect may sound like a moderate when he's wooing liberal Times editors, but his cabinet nominations and staffing choices so far have been those of an extremist Republican. If Trump were softening his positions, would he have picked Myron Ebel, a professional climate change denier, to lead his transition team for the Environmental Protection Agency, or immigration hardliner Senator Jeff Sessions to be Attorney General? To his credit, Trump was fairly blunt on the campaign trail about what he hoped to achieve in office, said Matthew Iglesias in Vox.com. He vowed to crack down on illegal immigration and slash corporate taxes. No president manages to follow through on every campaign promise, of course, but it does look as if Trump is prepping to take a real shot at doing what he can. Trying to determine Trump's actual beliefs or agenda is like trying to nail Jell-O to a wall, said Harry Enten in 538.com. His transition picks may indicate an instinct to go hard right, but Trump's own words really have been much more moderate since the election. He has barely mentioned immigration, the centerpiece of his campaign. The only policy outlined in his victory speech was a New Deal-ish program of infrastructure spending. And in a YouTube video outlining the agenda for his first 100 days, Trump almost sounded like a Bernie Sanders-style Democrat, with a focus on jobs, worker-friendly trade deals, and lobbying reform. So far, President-elect Trump is a vast improvement over Trump the candidate, said Fareed Zakaria in WashingtonPost.com. If this is flip-flopping, we should all hope that he flip-flops some more. Trump's not a flip-flopper, said Selena Zito in NYPost.com. He's a businessman, and business people change their minds a lot. Why? Not because they lack courage or conviction, but because they care more about real-world results than about ideological purity. To a lifelong dealmaker like Donald Trump, everything is negotiable, and the flexible, freewheeling pragmatism he displayed throughout the campaign was evidently a quality that voters found attractive. Maybe so, said Kathleen Parker in the Washington Post, but they were also attracted by Trump's unambiguous promises to bring back jobs, defeat ISIS, fix the U.S. healthcare system, and do so much else. If he doesn't start delivering, and quickly, his supporters may soon join the rest of us in wondering just who is the real Donald Trump and what does he stand for? Well, it was a good week for crowdsourcing. After NASA announced that it would pay a $30,000 award to anyone who could help devise a hygienic way for astronauts to poop and pee inside their spacesuits without having to use an uncomfortable diaper. It was a good week for Going Gonzo after Hunter S. Thompson's widow, Anita, announced plans to sell strains of marijuana cultivated from the remnants of the writer's personal stash. I'm looking forward to being a drug lord, she said. It was a good week for feeling the spirit after scientists at the University of Utah discovered that engaging in prayer has the same effect on religious people's brains as having sex. We're just beginning to understand how the brain participates in experiences that believers interpret as spiritual, divine, or transcendent, said lead researcher Jeffrey Anderson. But it was a bad week for helicopter parenting after a court in Switzerland ruled that a 7-year-old boy must attend a specialized school because his doting parents spoiled him so much that he can't cope with the challenges of a regular school environment. It was a bad week for kind words after Dictionary.com announced that xenophobia was its word of the year for 2016. The site saw a huge spike in searches for the term, which is defined as fear and hatred of foreigners, in the wake of the Brexit vote and as Donald Trump moved closer to securing the GOP nomination. And it was a bad week for love potions after North Korean dictator Kim Jong-un ordered his country's scientists to develop a cure for male sexual dysfunction using snake extracts, sea urchins, and mushrooms soaked in alcohol. Moving on to the briefing page, this week titled, Trump's Most Trusted Advisor. Jared Kushner, the president-elect's reserved son-in-law, will play a major role in his administration. Who is Jared Kushner? Ivanka Trump's husband is a real estate developer who, like Donald Trump, inherited a fortune from his father and grew it through daring deals. Kushner, age 35, is worth an estimated $200 million. He's also one of Donald Trump's closest advisors and helped engineer his upset victory over Hillary Clinton. The president-elect knows that the only person Jared is looking out for is the president-elect, said Jason Miller, communication director for Trump's transition team. He doesn't have any other agendas or motives or fiefdoms. And in the world of politics, that's frequently hard to find. In stark contrast to his bombastic father-in-law, Kushner is reserved, modest, and unfailingly polite. Yet they are described as kindred spirits, men born to wealth who nonetheless see themselves as scorned outsiders with something to prove. Why is that? Manhattan's cultural elite has long mocked Queens-born Trump for his gold-plated gaucherie. New Jersey native Kushner, on the other hand, has faced skepticism ever since Daniel Golden's 2006 book, The Price of Admission, which suggested Kushner's father, Charles, used a $2.5 million donation to get Jared into Harvard University. His GPA did not warrant it. His SAT scores did not warrant it, said an official at Kushner's high school. The book was the second humiliating blow Kushner had to absorb at a young age. The year before Golden's book came out, Kushner's father was sent to prison after a scandalous trial involving family feud, sex, and blackmail. When Kushner took over his father's business, Kushner Companies, at age 24, he quickly set out to redeem his family's reputation and prove his own mettle. What did he do? He expanded into New York City. He knew early in his career that the way to become important was to get out of Jersey and become a Manhattan developer, said Mitchell Moss, urban planning professor at New York University. In 2007, Kushner put up $1.8 billion in mostly borrowed funds to purchase the 41-story office building at 666 Fifth Avenue, a near disaster when values plummeted after the 2008 financial crisis. But he has found enormous success by investing in office and residential buildings in Soho, Brooklyn, and other hip rising areas. When did he meet Ivanka? A real estate broker introduced them, and they began dating in 2007. I feel really lucky to have met her, like a great New Jersey boy, Ivanka said. The stumbling block was religion. Ivanka was a Presbyterian and Kushner a devout Orthodox Jew whose parents hoped he'd marry within the faith. The conflict led to a 2008 breakup, but when they got back together after Ivanka promised to convert to Judaism. Her future in-laws didn't make it easy, insisting on rigorous study of the Torah. It was hard and difficult, and it was on Charlie's terms, said former Observer Media President Bob Sommer. Ivanka passed the test, and they wed in 2009 at Trump National Golf Club in Bedminster, New Jersey. Kushner and Ivanka have three children, keep the Sabbath, and often spend weekends with Jared's parents at their Jersey Shore mansion. It was understood that marriage meant loyalty to their in-laws, said former Hollywood super agent Michael Ovitz, another mentor. Incidentally, Jared discovered that he really liked Donald. When Trump ran for president, Kushner became deeply involved in the campaign. How did that happen? Kushner said he became a true believer last November after watching Trump thrill a packed arena in Springfield, Illinois. People really saw hope in his message, Kushner said. Convinced his father-in-law could win, he encouraged him to make better use of computer data and social media. Kushner called on friends in Silicon Valley, he says, and had them give me a tutorial on how to use Facebook micro-targeting. Last summer, Kushner built a data hub, which gathered a trove of constituent information to identify possible Trump voters. The data pointed to momentum in the Rust Belt, prompting last-minute rallies and outreach that helped the Republicans turn those states red. Kushner managed to assemble a presidential campaign on a shoestring using new technology and won, says former Google CEO Eric Schmidt, who assisted the Clinton campaign. That's a big deal. What role will he play now? He has already helped direct the transition as a liaison to his father-in-law and reportedly helped orchestrate the ouster of original transition leader Chris Christie, the man who had prosecuted Kushner's father. Federal anti-nepotism laws may bar him from a paid post and perhaps even an unpaid one, but Trump has signaled Kushner will nonetheless play a key advisory role and become a formidable force in the Trump White House. Indeed, despite Kushner's utter lack of diplomatic experience, Trump suggests he might ask his son-in-law to broker an elusive Israeli-Palestinian peace. I think he'd be very good at it, Trump says. He knows the region, knows the people, knows the players. Moving into the best columns, two from the U.S. The Dems need new blood. It's time for House Democratic Leader Nancy Pelosi and her septuagenarian deputies to step aside, said Dana Milbank. If Democrats ever hope to recover from the Trump debacle and regain control of Congress, they desperately need an infusion of young talent. Pelosi, Minority Whip Steny Hoyer, and number three House Democrat Jim Clyburn are talented and accomplished public servants, but they're all in their late 70s. Their combined ages would date back to 1787, the year George Washington presided over the signing of the Constitution. Their governing style, passionately ideological and unyielding, is emblematic of their generation, and it has given us cultural warfare and dysfunction. That's why Ohio Representative Tim Ryan's long-shot challenge for the minority leader post this week was such a welcome development. Ryan, a 43-year-old former high school quarterback, drinks at the Open Hearth Bar on Steele Street in Youngstown with blue-collar Democrats who feel abandoned by a party led by coastal elites. Ryan understands that many of those voters flipped to Trump not because they agreed with his racial politics, but because they liked his economic populism and wanted to say, go screw yourself to the establishment. Ryan may have lost his challenge, but it's not too late for the Democratic establishment to start listening. Putin's final push on Aleppo. Vladimir Putin believes he's found the perfect moment to batter the Syrian city of Aleppo into submission, said Tom Rogan. Syrian government forces, backed by weeks of brutal Russian airstrikes, are close to seizing the entirety of the rebel-held city. For the various opposition forces fighting Bashar al-Assad's regime, the loss of Aleppo will be devastating, both strategically and for morale. But that's not why Russia and its allies have waited until now for their final push on the long-besieged city. Putin clearly senses that President Obama has given up on Syria. Putin therefore feels empowered to do his worst while Obama remains in office. At the same time, the Russian president knows that U.S. foreign policy under a Trump presidency is a wild card. Trump may appear sympathetic to Moscow now, but once he learns more about what Russia is actually doing in Syria, for example, not targeting ISIS, his approach could shift quickly. That's why Putin hopes to crush Aleppo now rather than later. He's clearly gambling that come Inauguration Day in Washington, images of bloodied Syrians will be an afterthought in Western minds. In this column from Germany, Merkel can't save the free world. Many politicians have made the mistake of underestimating Angela Merkel, said Gunnar Johnson. They were fooled by the chancellor's quiet, competent approach, only to discover at the last minute that she'd outmaneuvered them. But there is now a real danger in overestimating Merkel, who announced last week that she would run for a fourth term as chancellor in 2017. After the UK voted for Brexit and the US elected a wild man named Donald Trump, liberals around the world have looked expectantly to Berlin, hoping Merkel will take care of the entire free world. She can't. Her political power is diminishing at home, in part because of her decision last year to let some 1 million refugees settle in Germany. Her role as the unchallenged leader of the EU is being undermined by the rise of populist, nationalist parties across the continent. Reactionary movements fed by Merkel's insistence that austerity, not public spending, is the cure for Europe's economic ills. And if Trump continues cozying up to Russia and pulls back from the Atlantic Alliance, Germany cannot replace the Americans as NATO's spine. Its military is too small, and its pacifist instincts too strong. Germany needs a peaceful world order to export its cars, but Merkel cannot shape that world. And we're on to the last word, our in-depth article. Title this week, Pushing Themselves to the Extreme. Why would anyone sign up for 700 miles of swimming, biking, and running over five consecutive days, said journalist Randall Archibald. If you have to ask, these racers say, you'll never understand. Crushed by exhaustion, you may dream of a competitor's head morphing into a Pokemon-like demon, and then open your eyes and still see it. The next day, you will quit the race. To fill your queasy stomach during your third 112-mile bike ride, you will discover the best way to eat a sausage and egg sandwich. Shove it in your mouth and let it slowly dissolve. After 500 miles on a bike, 10 in the water, and more than 100 on foot, it will make perfect sense to grab a branch and a broomstick in a desperate bid to propel yourself like a giant mutant insect the last 31 miles. It will not be enough. You will collapse on the road. Seasick, miles into the swim, you will vomit twice. Neck cramps will attack so fiercely on the bike that your head will slump. You will go cross-eyed and nearly crash. You will swear bugs are crawling over your face, even when they are not. The cracks in the road will form smiley faces. None of this is real, but it is 3 a.m., and you have dozens of miles still to run. All that misery and more menaced the competitors who had decided for their own unfathomable reasons that a single Ironman race was not enough. They had entered as an endurance event called the Virginia Quintuple Anvil Triathlon, five Ironman length races totaling 703 miles of swimming, biking, and running over 5 days. All the legs were done in confined loops, 30 laps in a section of the lake, 101 laps of more than 5 mile course for the bike, and 75 laps of a nearly 2-mile course for the run at Lake Anna State Park in Virginia's Spotsylvania County, earning the course the moniker Squirrel Cage. The competitors, several of whom have formed a tight family-like circle, having seen one another often at these kinds of races, were a mishmash of the super fit and the merely fit. Military veterans, including a couple of former commandos, driven professionals, and simple thrill seekers who found plenty. Most were middle-aged. Most had grown children who would not miss them much in the long hours of training. And most had supportive spouses and family members, in some case, triathletes themselves. Some of those family members came to watch their loved ones destroy their bodies, if not their minds, for nearly a week because why? If you have to ask, more than a few racers replied, you will never know. You may have heard that idea expressed at, say, the regular old Ironman triathlon, which is normally considered the Mount Everest of the sport, a 2.4-mile swim, then a 112-mile bike ride, and then a marathon, 26.2 miles, in the heat of Hawaii. If you could finish it, you were, well, an Ironman, or woman. People began flocking to the challenge. Races popped up on every continent except Antarctica. The first Ironman was in Hawaii in 1978 with 15 competitors. Today there are 140 races to choose from, drawing 260,000 competitors. But once you have swum 2.4 miles, biked 112, and run 26.2 miles in a day, why stop there? As early as 1984, a double Ironman race was held in Alabama, and then a triple, and then a quintuple, and then a deca, 10 Ironmans in 10 days, and a double deca. And you see where this is going. Wayne Kurtz, who is considered the godfather of the so-called ultra triathletes, and seven others did 30 Ironman length races in 30 days in Italy in 2013. He wrote about it in a book called Stronger Than Iron. With this kind of test, he wrote, these athletes were not racing for money or fame, but purely to discover what is possible in terms of endurance limits. How did it go? I was hit by a car 3 times, Kurt said in an interview. It was a zoo. We're lucky nobody died. One of the more popular races is the Quintuple Anvil, which grew to 16 competitors this year from 7 in 2013, its inaugural year. Double and triple versions are held at the same time. By the time you consider a quadruple, you might as well just do a quintuple. This is the mentality here. Anvil is a tongue-in-cheek spin on Iron Man, which is run by a large corporation fiercely protective of its trademark and not keen on letting other races use it. Competitors may choose one of two ways to mete out their self-flagellation. Do one Ironman length triathlon a day for 5 days, abiding a 17-hour cutoff, or do all of it continuously, a 12-mile swim followed by a 560-mile bike ride and a 31-mile run stretched out over 5.5 days, broken up however you wish. The 1x5 variant means you can get a longish night's sleep, but you have to get up for a 7 a.m. start every day, a fitness nut's groundhog day. The continuous version usually involves a fair amount of sleep deprivation, in particular to get the long bike ride and run legs done. This is the fitness nut's walking dead. By the end, the mind is shot from exhaustion, and the legs and feet have taken so much punishment that hardly anybody is doing much running. My own triathlon experience has been limited to a few sprint races of short distances, some Olympic distance races, a swim of just under a mile, a 24-mile bike ride, and a 6.2-mile run, and one half Ironman, 1.2-mile swim, 56-mile ride, 13.1-mile run. The half Ironman done in the tropical heat of Panama left me staggering at the end and had me pretty sure that I had found my limit, and it wasn't happy to see me. Just beyond the finish line, there was an ice bath, which I felt like moving into permanently. When I told this to Shanda Hill, who ended up one of the top finishers at the Anvil, she smiled and, with the evangelical fervor common among the racers, started pushing me to do at least an Ironman length race. "It's all mental," Hill, 34, said, "and I am living proof." By that, she meant that she had not devoted long hours to swimming, biking, or running. But she did spend a lot of time in the gym and was also fit from a youth of championship BMX racing, a pursuit that ended several years ago when she was hit by an SUV while riding a bike home. She began running after that, moved up to ultra marathons, and before long was doing her first Ironman in 2014. Then came a double race, and by her logic, if you were going to move up to a triple, you might as well just do the quintuple. This was her fifth triathlon overall, and like many of the other athletes, she would insist that endurance triathlons had as much, if not more, to do with the limits of the mind as with those of the body. Lisa Y. Haas, who did a double, said, "Shorter triathlons are about pain. Endurance triathlons are about suffering. How much suffering can you take?" Face down on a cot near midnight in the middle of the race, Will Turner had a massage therapist kneading his muscles, trying to coax some life into them. He was, at 58, an Ironman veteran who last year moved up to multiple distance races by doing a double Ironman length race. "He believes in big dreams," he said, and he dedicated his entry to his recently deceased mother. This race, the continuous quintuple Anvil, would also be a test toward a bigger goal. 60 Ironman length races, one every 6 days, when he turned 60. The test was not going well. "I have been hanging out in the pain cave," he said. Like other racers, Turner had a group of people attending to him, although as a resident of nearby Richmond, he had more than anybody else. Limited medical assistance is permitted, too. A doctor and a nurse dispense ibuprofen, pop blisters when necessary, and even give shots of lidocaine to ailing tendons, a small dose that is meant to get a faltering competitor moving and does not last long. To qualify, a competitor must have finished at least a double Ironman length race. Yet here was Jerome Lebecki, 46, doing his first ever triathlon. He had sort of slipped into the race, although he had done other endurance events. He needed a friend to persuade the race director to let him in. His triathlon inexperience showed. About 300 miles into the bike leg, after a friend took a harder look at his bike, he realized he needed to shift into a higher gear. By the run, for him and many others, it eventually slowed to the walk. Lebecki was the one who hobbled on like a giant insect with makeshift crutches. "This is the last thing I figured would happen," he said at 3 a.m., panting and sweating. But still, he vowed to go on. Even in the grip of exhaustion, there was a thirst for competition. Lebecki and Turner, in their spotted gaits, still eyed each other as they passed, as if in a last man standing kind of way. People race to win, after all, and as if physical demands of such a contest were not enough, some resort to psychological warfare. They misinform one another about whether they intend to nap, or they press on when they see a rival catching a snooze. They burst into a sprint when they see another competitor walking. Some methodically plot when to give their all and when to hold back. Dolph Hoke IV, 52, a former military sniper, won the one-per-day quintuple division in a time of 74 hours, 54 minutes, 17 seconds, beating five other competitors, including two who quit. Unlike the other racers, Hoke conserved enough energy to complete his day 4, 14:25:04, and day 5, 14:46:31, races faster than he had done day one, 14:59:21. The first day I was getting lapped on the bike, he said after the race, his thighs now screaming. Fifth day I had the fastest split. They had no idea I was saving my spin. In my estimation, he also won best food trick as the one who let the sausage sandwich dissolve in his mouth. The most grinding competition, however, was between David Jepson and Johan Desmet. It was not quite a Rocky-like spectacle, but with Jepson 40 looking to be falling apart at times, it did take on that feeling. At a rest stop, he threw down his bike helmet in frustration over cramps that had left him unable to hold his head up and nearly led to a crash. But with reassuring words from his wife, Jepson regained his footing on the run despite a multiple of maladies. A golf ball-sized blood blister on his foot he eventually popped, a shin splint, ankle tendons so sore they needed to be stabilized by duct tape, and bruising and chafing on the bottoms of his feet that made every step searing. Running was not much of an option anymore. Desmet, 49, who is Belgian and a marathon runner, kept up an efficient gait for a good amount of the run and rarely complained about his ordeal despite the blisters and sores on his feet. One of them, a race nurse concluded, was from the bite of an insect that had gotten inside his shoe. "You're not drinking enough," interrupted his wife, Helene, who served as only his only crew member, handing him water during a late evening break. "You always say that," he said, taking a sip. Helene was ready for the race to be over. And so was he. After 6 years of ultra racing, he was planning to pursue other adventures. "It's a pretty selfish sport," Desmet said. "She's been putting up with this for close to 7 years." In the end, Jepson won the continuous division with a time of 104:47:39. Desmet, still on the course, realized the best he could do was second place. "I am going to be first loser," he cracked. This was excerpted from an article that originally appeared in the New York Times. And an obituary for you this week. The Cuban dictator who defied the U.S. for half a century. Fidel Castro, 1926 to 2016. Just after midnight on November 25th, 1956, a group of 82 Cuban exiles boarded a leaky motor yacht in the Mexican port of Tuxpan and set off for their homeland. The revolutionaries planned to overthrow Cuba's brutal U.S.-backed dictator, General Fulgencio Batista. Their mission didn't start off well. The Granma ran aground off the Cuban coast, forcing the men to wade ashore and abandon much of their equipment. For 3 nights, they trudged toward the Sierra Maestra Mountains, and at dawn on December 5th, they were attacked by government troops. Most of the rebels were killed or captured, but the group's leader, a charismatic left-winger named Fidel Castro, escaped. Together with his younger brother, Raul, and Ernesto Che Guevara, Castro spent the next 20 months waging a guerrilla war and fuming at U.S. support for Batista. "The Americans will pay dearly," he wrote. "When this war is over, a much longer and greater war will begin for me, the war I am going to wage against them." Castro was true to his word. After seizing power in 1959, El Comandante turned Cuba into a repressive, Moscow-allied communist state, became a thorn in the side of 11 U.S. presidents, and pushed the world to the brink of nuclear war. "Condemn me, it doesn't matter," he declared during his 1953 trial for a failed uprising. "History will absolve me." Born on the eastern tip of Cuba, Castro was the illegitimate son of a Spanish soldier turned wealthy landowner and his maid, said the Washington Post. Educated at prestigious boarding schools, he was mocked by richer kids as a guajiro, or peasant, instilling in him a hatred of moneyed people. Castro became interested in politics while studying law at the University of Havana, and after graduating ran for Congress. But shortly before Election Day, Batista took power in a coup and canceled the vote. The 25-year-old Castro declared personal war on the new dictatorship, said the Miami Herald. He built a clandestine revolutionary group, and in 1953 led 111 poorly armed rebels in an attack on Cuba's second largest army barracks. The raid was a disaster, and 69 rebels were killed. But it made Castro, who was arrested and sentenced to 15 years in prison, the top anti-Batista leader overnight. Granted amnesty 2 years later, Castro fled to Mexico, said BBC.com. There he met Che Guevara, a young Argentine revolutionary, and the two men began building their ragtag invasion force. After setting up base in the Sierra Maestra, Castro won over oppressed peasants and urban intellectuals and issued manifestos promising free elections, social reform, and justice. His band of several hundred fighters scored enough victories against Batista's demoralized army to force the dictator to flee Cuba on January 1, 1959. A week later, a cigar-chomping Castro, then 32, entered Havana atop a tank, said the Wall Street Journal. He immediately halved rents and turned cattle ranches and sugar plantations into small farms for the poor. He also revealed a ruthless streak. Thousands of Batista police and military officers were executed. Elections were postponed, and dissidents and gay men were jailed. Revolutionary justice is not based on legal precepts, Castro said, but on moral conviction. The U.S. broke off diplomatic relations with Cuba in January 1961 after Castro began nationalizing U.S.-owned businesses, said CNN.com. 4 months later, with concern mounting in the U.S. over Havana's shift toward Moscow, a group of CIA-trained Cuban exiles armed with U.S. weapons landed at the Bay of Pigs in Cuba. The attempted coup failed miserably and cemented Castro's status as a national hero. He formally declared Cuba a socialist state, prompting the U.S. to impose a full trade embargo that still exists today. Furious at this humiliation on the world stage, President John F. Kennedy ramped up his anti-Castro campaign. The CIA considered dozens of ways to kill the Cuban leader: exploding seashells, poisoned diving suits, mafia hitmen, all to no avail. Tensions rocketed further in October 1962 when CIA aerial surveillance identified several new Soviet nuclear missile installations on Cuba, bases within 100 miles of Florida. Kennedy demanded Moscow withdraw its 42 missiles and ordered a naval blockade of the island, said the Times, UK. For 13 days, the superpowers confronted each other, and the world came as close as it ever has to nuclear war. When Soviet leader Nikita Khrushchev backed down, Castro was furious. He kicked his office wall, bringing a mirror smashing down, and called Khrushchev a faggot. Meanwhile, the disastrous consequences of Castro's economic strategy and the U.S. embargo were becoming clear, said the Daily Telegraph. Basic items, light bulbs, soap, paper, disappeared from stores. Desperate to flee poverty and repression, more than 260,000 Cubans immigrated to America in a U.S.-organized airlift from 1965 to 1973. In 1980, another 125,000 fled in the chaotic Mariel boat lift. With the help of Soviet aid, Castro did make some notable advances. Free health care raised life expectancies, and improved schooling raised standards of literacy. Yet the Cuban leader seemed less concerned with domestic affairs and more with becoming the chief apostle of global revolution. At great expense, he sent soldiers to support communist uprisings around the world, from Algeria to Laos, from Afghanistan to Colombia. Castro's greatest challenge came in 1991, when the Soviet Union's collapse brought an end to the subsidies that had kept his government afloat for so long, said the New York Times. Cuba's GDP plummeted 40% in 2 years. Power cuts lasted 16 hours a day, and immigration surged. Yet Castro fought on. He made it legal for Cubans to hold U.S. dollars, opened the country to foreign tourism, and persuaded Pope John Paul II to visit Cuba in 1998. Despite his love of the limelight, he often gave grandstanding speeches lasting 12 hours. Castro kept his private life largely hidden from public view, said The Economist. He lived for most of his life with his second wife, former school teacher Dalia de Soto Valle, with whom he had 5 sons. But he also had numerous mistresses and illegitimate children. In his later years, Castro appeared increasingly frail, said the Los Angeles Times. He temporarily handed over power to his brother Raul after undergoing intestinal surgery in 2006 and resigned 2 years later. Raul embarked on a reform program that would have been unthinkable under his brother, allowing Cubans to buy and sell cars and homes and to open small businesses. In 2014, Raul and President Obama announced a stunning turnaround in U.S.-Cuban relations, restoring diplomatic ties after 5 decades of estrangement. Fidel didn't approve. "We do not need the empire," he wrote, "to give us anything." Okay, we're pretty deep in the program. We'll take just one of the health and science articles this week. Dementia rates decline. The percentage of older people with dementia is on the decline, even though a cure for this devastating condition remains elusive, the New York Times reports. Based on surveys of 21,000 older adults, University of Michigan found the dementia rate among older Americans fell from about 12% in 2000 to roughly 9% in 2012. This translates to about 1 million fewer Americans suffering from the condition. The reasons for this unexpected drop aren't clear. Scientists speculate that more people are receiving effective treatment for conditions like linked to dementia, such as diabetes and high blood pressure, both of which can impair blood flow to the brain. It's also possible that a climb in the average education levels of older adults plays a role. Previous studies suggest that higher learning creates more complicated connections between nerve cells, which may help protect the brain against cognitive decline. But while the risk for dementia may be decreasing slightly, study author Dr. Kenneth Lange warns that the total number of Americans with dementia will continue to climb as the massive baby boomer generation moves into its 60s, 70s, and 80s. This is still going to be a top priority issue for families and for health policy now and in the coming decades. And we'll move right into the talking points page. Identity politics, the Democrats' downfall. For the Democrats, no activity is immune from reflexive accusations of sexism and racism, said Rich Lowry in NationalReview.com. Not even soul searching. Since the election, a few liberals have spoken out against the party's self-limiting obsession with identity politics, and they've all been angrily shouted down. Senator Bernie Sanders was castigated for pointing out that Democrats won't win votes simply by saying, "I'm a woman, vote for me." Democratic Representative Tim Ryan argued that his party shouldn't divide the electorate up into aggrieved groups, a point that was illustrated perfectly when a left-wing writer accused him of sexism for mounting a challenge against House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi. Meanwhile, a thoughtful essay by Columbia professor Mark Lilla on America's liberalism's moral panic over race, gender, and sexual identity sparked a moral panic of its own, focused on overwhelmingly on how Lilla is, in fact, himself a white male. Will Democrats ever be able to quit identity politics? Liberals are right not to change course, said Olivia Gyarki in NewRepublic.com. We focus on race, gender, and sexuality because these issues don't exist in a vacuum, and they are inextricably linked to broader societal challenges. How can we talk about class without recognizing that the poorest Americans are often people of color? Can we really discuss the common good without acknowledging that women, blacks, and LGBT people are still treated as outsiders? Democrats should definitely champion the interest of working people, said Michelle Goldberg in Slate.com, but not if it requires abandoning others whose freedoms and rights are under threat. With President Trump in the Oval Office and Jeff Sessions, a racist opponent of the Voting Rights Act, as his attorney general, the dark years ahead will be those when minorities and other targeted groups need our support the most. Even if the Democratic Party wanted to change tack, its supporters wouldn't allow it, said Daniel Payne in TheFederalist.com. After decades of aggressive identity politicking, many liberals won't take kindly to being asked to cool their rhetoric on social injustice or gender identities, particularly millennials, who have never known any different. And abandoning identity politics will become even harder under Trump, the left's boogeyman on pretty much all these issues. For moderate Democrats, even subtle rhetorical reform would be a massive uphill battle. And we will wrap up today with a short quote from Amy Poehler, comedian, quoted in Allure.com. She says, "Nobody looks stupid when they're having fun." We've run out of time for today's episode of the week. Be sure to listen again next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Fred Woodward. The Triangle Radio Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This broadcast is available as a podcast right after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. Questions or comments? Give us a call, 919-832-5138.